on how we feel when others show us warmth and affection, or observe how our own affectionate feelings or attitudes automatically and naturally affect us. These gentler emotions and the positive behaviors that go with them lead to a happier family and community life. So, I think that one can infer that our fundamental nature is one of gentleness. And if this is the case, then it makes all the more sense to try to live a way of life which would be more in accordance with this basic gentle nature of our being.
But if this is the case, one also naturally wonders why there is so much aggression and conflict in the world.
Of course, anger, violence, and aggression may certainly arise, but I think it's only on a secondary or more superficial level, in a sense. It arises when we are frustrated in our efforts to achieve love and affection. They are not part of our most basic underlying nature. So although aggression can occur, I believe that these conflicts aren't necessarily because of human nature, but rather a result of the human intellect, unbalanced human intelligence, misuse of our imaginative faculty. I believe that our most fundamental nature is gentleness, and our intellect developed later in the course of human evolution. And if that human ability, that human intelligence develops in an unbalanced way, without being properly counterbalanced with compassion, then it can become destructive. But I think it's important to recognize that if human conflicts are created by misuses of human intelligence, we can also utilize our intelligence to find ways and means to overcome these conflicts. When human intelligence and human goodness or affection are used together, all human actions become constructive. When we combine a warm heart with knowledge and education, we can learn to respect others' views and others' rights. This becomes the basis of a spirit of reconciliation that can be used to overcome aggression and resolve our conflicts.
The Dalai Lama's view of the underlying compassionate nature of human beings seems to slowly be gaining ground in the West. Over the past two or three decades, there have been hundreds of scientific studies indicating that aggression and violence is not innate. It is not genetically programmed into human nature. Violent behavior is influenced by a variety of biological, social, situational, and environmental factors. Even though we have the neural apparatus to act violently, that behavior is not automatically activated. Most contemporary researchers in the field currently feel that we have the potential to develop into gentle, caring people or violent, aggressive people. The impulse that gets emphasized is largely a matter of training. Once we conclude that the basic nature of humanity is compassionate rather than aggressive, our relationship to the world around us changes immediately. Seeing others as basically gentle instead of antagonistic and selfish helps us to relax, trust, live at ease. It allows us to wake up each morning in an atmosphere of kindness rather than one of hostility and apprehension. It makes us happier.
First meditation on the purpose of life.
When life becomes too complicated and we feel overwhelmed, it's often useful just to stand back and remind ourselves that our overall goal is happiness. This can put our life back in proper context, allow a fresh perspective, and enable us to see what direction to take. The Dalai Lama's understanding of the factors that ultimately lead to happiness is based on a lifetime of methodically observing his own mind, exploring the nature of the human condition, and investigating these things within a framework first established by the Buddha over 25 centuries ago. And from this background, he has come to some definite conclusions about which activities are most worthwhile. His words, a summary of his beliefs, can be used as the basis of a meditation, as part of your own pursuit of happiness.
Sometimes when I meet old friends, it reminds me how quickly time passes, and it makes me wonder if we've utilized our time properly or not. proper utilization of time is so important. While we have this body, and especially this amazing human brain, I think every minute is something precious. Our day-to-day existence is very much alive with hope. Although there is no guarantee of one's future, there is no guarantee that tomorrow at this time we will be here. But still, we are working for that purely on the basis of hope, so we need to make the best use of our time. I believe that the proper utilization of time is this. If you can, serve other people, other sentient beings. If not, at least refrain from harming them. I think that is the whole basis of my philosophy. So let us reflect on what is truly of value in life, what gives meaning to our lives, and set our priorities based on that. The purpose of our life needs to be positive. We weren't born with the purpose of causing trouble, harming others. For our life truly to be of value, I think we must develop basic good human qualities: warmth, kindness, compassion. Then our life becomes meaningful and more peaceful, happier.
Part 2, Human Warmth and Compassion. Chapter 5, A New Model for Intimacy.
Within all beings, there is the seed of perfection. However, compassion is required in order to activate that seed, which is inherent in our heart and minds.
Satisfying and fulfilling human relationships is a key ingredient to a happier life, and I spent some time discussing the subject with the Dalai Lama. One afternoon, while sitting in a hotel lobby waiting for my meeting with him to begin, I'd been absently reading the personal section of a local alternative newspaper. Densely packed pages of people searching desperately to connect with another human being. Still thinking of those ads as I sat down to begin my session with the Dalai Lama, I asked if he ever got lonely. To my surprise, he said no. I asked him why that was.
I think one factor is that I look at any human being from a more positive angle. I try to look for their positive aspects. This attitude immediately creates a feeling of affinity, a kind of connectiveness, and it may partly be because, on my part, there is less apprehension, less fear, that if I act in a certain way, maybe the person will lose respect or think that I am strange. So, because that kind of fear and apprehension is absent, there's a kind of openness.
Loneliness is so pervasive in our society that I never expected to confront anyone who did not experience it. The Dalai Lama's explanation surprised me, and I wondered how one could develop that degree of comfort with other people, free from a fear of being disliked or judged by others, and maintaining that feeling of genuine connection with others to the point of never feeling lonely.
My basic belief is that you first need to realize the usefulness of compassion. Once you accept the fact that compassion is not something childish or sentimental, realize its deeper value, then you immediately develop an attraction towards it, a willingness to cultivate it. And once you encourage the thought of compassion in your mind, once that thought becomes active, then your attitude towards others changes automatically. That will automatically reduce fear and allow an openness with other people. It creates a positive, friendly atmosphere. With that attitude, you can approach a relationship in which you, yourself, initially create the possibility of receiving affection or a positive response from the other person. That kind of openness at least allows the possibility of having meaningful conversation with them, even if they are unfriendly at first, but without the attitude of compassion. If you are feeling closed, irritated, or indifferent, then you can even be approached by your best friend and you just feel uncomfortable. I think that in many cases people expect the other person to respond to them in a positive way first, rather than taking the initiative themselves to create that possibility. I feel that's wrong, and can act as a barrier that just serves to promote a feeling of isolation from others. So if you wish to overcome the feeling of isolation and loneliness, I think that your underlying attitude makes a tremendous difference, and approaching others with a thought of compassion in your mind is the best way to do this.
In addition to our private discussions, the Dalai Lama had introduced the idea of compassion in his public talks as well. He explained in detail the importance of our compassionate interaction with other sentient beings, and stressed the importance of understanding that life is made up of inextricable links to other people, both known and unknown, on whom we depend. I sat among the crowd of 1,500 people that afternoon, listening to him speak of these ideas, but for some reason I felt a certain instinctive resistance to what he was saying. Although I've always highly valued my family and friends, I've always prided myself on self-reliance and considered myself to be an independent person. Secretly, perhaps, I've tended to regard overly dependent people with a kind of contempt, a sign of weakness. Yet that afternoon, as the Dalai Lama spoke, something happened. As our dependence on others was not my favorite topic, my mind had started to wander and I found myself absently removing a loose thread from my shirt sleeve. As the Dalai Lama spoke about how we are all dependent on others' efforts and cooperation, I began to think about all the people who were involved in the making of my shirt. I started by imagining the farmer who grew the cotton. Next, the salesman who sold him the tractor to plow the field. Then the hundreds or even thousands of people involved in manufacturing that tractor, including the people who mine the ore to make the metal for each part of the tractor, and all the designers of the tractor. Then, of course, the people who processed the cotton and wove the cloth, the people who cut, dyed, and sewed that cloth, the cargo workers and truck drivers delivering it to the store, and the salesperson who sold it to me. It occurred to me that virtually every aspect of my life came about as a result of other people's efforts. My precious self-reliance was a complete illusion. As this realization dawned on me, I was overcome with a profound sense of the interconnectedness and interdependence of all beings. I felt a softening, something. It made me want to cry. The Dalai Lama's views about loneliness and human interconnectedness had been surprising and enlightening. But in discussing human relationships, it is clear that there are many different kinds of relationships, many different ways in which we can relate to one another. In Western culture, for instance, it is considered important to have one special person with whom you can share a deep intimacy, a person such as a lover or a spouse. I was curious about the Dalai Lama's personal background in this regard. Had his being raised as a monk and leader of a nation from a very early age, and even worshipped as a kind of deity, create a sense of distance and isolation from others? Did he regret his early separation from his family and the fact that he could not marry? Did he miss out on developing a deeper level of personal intimacy? And I wondered how his unique background and perspective might apply to our own intimate relationships.
I never felt a lack of intimacy. Of course, my father passed away many years ago, but I felt quite close to my mother, my teachers, my tutors, and others. And with many of these people, I could share my deepest feelings, fears, and concerns. When I was in Tibet on state occasions and at public events, there was a certain formality, a certain protocol was observed, but that wasn't always the case. At other times, for instance, I used to spend time in the kitchen, and I became quite close with some of the kitchen staff, and we could joke or gossip or share things, and it would be quite relaxed, without that sense of formality or distance. Since I've become a refugee, I've never felt a lack of people with whom I can share things. And it's not just a matter of knowing people and having a superficial exchange, but really sharing my deepest problems and suffering. I feel this sense of intimacy, connection, of sharing with my friends, with many people. For instance, in the past, if I felt disappointed or unhappy with Tibetan government policy, or I was concerned with other problems, even the threat of Chinese invasion, then I would return to my rooms and share this with the person who sweeps the floor. From one point of view, it may seem quite silly, the Dalai Lama the head of the Tibetan government, facing some international or national problems and sharing that with the sweeper. But personally, I feel it is very helpful because the other person participates and we can face the problem or suffering together.
The influential British psychoanalyst John Bowlby wrote that intimate attachments to other human beings are the hub around which a person's life revolves. From these intimate attachments, a person draws his strength and enjoyment of life. There seems to be universal agreement among all researchers in the field of human relationships that intimacy is central to our existence and is a critical factor in promoting physical and emotional health and well-being. While researchers and scientists all agree on this fact, they can't seem to agree on an exact definition of intimacy. There is a vast spectrum of different definitions and models of intimacy, ranging from defining intimacy purely in terms of physical contact to describing it as the experience of connectivity, a relationship to everything around us. And definitions of the most ideal form of intimacy also vary from culture to culture and tend to dramatically change over time as well. Looking at all the different definitions of human intimacy and how our ideas of intimacy change over time and from place to place, one fact becomes clear. There are infinite variations among people with respect to how they can experience a sense of closeness. This realization alone offers us a great opportunity. It means that at this very moment we have vast resources of intimacy available to us. The Dalai Lama, for example, serves as an illustration of how an individual can develop deep and intimate relationships despite his role in life that might tend to set him apart from others or isolate him, and his monastic upbringing, which completely ruled out the possibility of forming the kinds of romantic personal relationships that are so sought after in Western culture. Today, so many of us are pressed by a feeling of something missing in our lives, intensely suffering from a lack of intimacy. This is particularly true when we go through the inevitable periods in our lives when we are not involved in a romantic relationship or when the passion wanes from our current relationship. There's a widespread notion in our culture that deep intimacy is best achieved within the context of a passionate, romantic relationship. This can be a profoundly limiting viewpoint, cutting us off from other potential sources of connection and the cause for much misery and unhappiness. But we have within our power the means to avoid this. Think of the personal column in the newspaper again. At the very moment that each person is composing his or her ad, struggling to find just the right words to bring romance into their lives and end the loneliness, many of these people are already surrounded by friends, family, or acquaintances, connections that can be easily cultivated into genuine and deeply satisfying human relationships. If what we seek in life is happiness, and intimacy is an important ingredient of a happier life, then it clearly makes sense to conduct our lives based on a model of intimacy that includes as many forms of connection with others as possible. The Dalai Lama's view offers such a model, a willingness to open oneself to many others, to family, friends, and even strangers, forming bonds based on compassion and one's common humanity.
Chapter 6, Love, Marriage, and Romance.
I think that if one is seeking to build a truly satisfying relationship, the best way of bringing this about is to get to know the deeper nature of the person and relate to her or him on that level, instead of merely on the basis of superficial characteristics. In this type of relationship, there is a role for genuine compassion. On the other hand, a relationship built primarily on sexual desire, for instance, is like a house built on a foundation of ice. As soon as the ice melts, the building collapses.
As a Buddhist monk, the Dalai Lama has developed satisfying relationships and found intimacy within the context of friendships. But studies have shown that marriage is one factor that can, in fact, bring happiness, providing the intimacy and close bonds that enhance health and overall life satisfaction. I wanted to bring up the subject of marriage, a conventional source of happiness in our culture, and had planned to begin one discussion by soliciting his opinion about all the joys and virtues of romance and marriage. A chance encounter with a bickering couple immediately before our meeting, however, prompted me to ask him instead about why conflicts and problems seem to arise so often in marriages.
Of course, when dealing with conflicts, there can be many factors involved. It can be quite complex. So when we are dealing with trying to understand relationship problems, the first stage involves deliberately reflecting on the underlying nature and basis of that relationship. So, first of all, one has to recognize that there are different types of relationships and understand the differences between them. For example, leaving aside the issue of marriage for a moment, even within ordinary friendships, we can recognize that there are different types of friendship. Some are based on wealth, power, or position. In these cases, your friendship continues as long as your power, wealth, or position is sustained. Once these grounds are no longer there, then the friendship will also begin to disappear. On the other hand, there are friendships based on true human feeling, a feeling of closeness, where there is a sense of sharing and connectiveness. That is what I would call genuine friendship. In the same way, if someone is running into problems with their spouse, it can be helpful to look at the underlying basis of the relationship. For example, you often find relationships very much based on immediate sexual attraction. When a couple has just met, seen each other on just a few occasions, they may be madly in love and very happy, but any decision about marriage made at that instant would be very shaky. Just as one can become, in some sense, insane from the power of intense anger or hatred, it is also possible for an individual to become, in some sense, insane by the power of passion or lust. A relationship based on that initial attraction is very unreliable and unstable because it is based on temporary phenomena. So it shouldn't be much of a surprise if that kind of relationship eventually runs into trouble. If the relationship is based only on sexual desire without a component of mutual respect, then the individual may be relating to each other not so much as people, but rather as objects, and the relationship becomes almost like prostitution, in which neither side has respect for the other. However, there is a second type of relationship which is also based on sexual attraction, but where the physical attraction is not the predominant basis of the relationship. In this second type, there is an underlying appreciation of the value of the other person, and you accord respect and dignity to that individual. And in order to establish that type of relationship, it is crucial to spend enough time to get to know each other in a genuine sense. Now, I've heard many people claim that their marriage has a deeper meaning than just a sexual relationship. That marriage involves two people trying to bond their lives together, share life's ups and downs together. If that claim is honest, then I believe that's the proper basis on which a relationship should be built. A sound relationship should include a sense of responsibility and commitment towards each other.
I brought up the idea of romance and its importance in Western society. Not just the physical sex act, but the whole idea of falling deeply in love, that blissful state which is so glorified in popular films, literature, and culture. I was surprised by the decisiveness of his response.
I think that, leaving aside how the endless pursuit of romantic love may affect our deeper spiritual growth, even from the perspective of a conventional way of life, the idealization of this romantic love can be seen as an extreme. Unlike those relationships based on caring and genuine affection, this is another matter. It's something based on a fantasy, unattainable, and therefore may be a source of frustration. So on that basis, it cannot be seen as a positive thing.
At first, I felt that the Dalai Lama was dismissing the idea of romance too lightly. Given his monastic background and training, it was understandable, perhaps, that he would take a dim view of romance. But in Western culture, the idea of romantic love has flourished for the past 200 years under the influence of the 19th century romantic movement. And long before that, the ancient Greeks had conceived of eros, romantic passionate love, as an ancient desire for fusion with a lost half of the self. Many contemporary researchers feel that the capacity to experience the intense feeling of falling in love may be programmed into our genes at birth as a genetically determined component of mating behavior, created by the production of certain chemicals in the brain. And the psychological drives towards falling in love may be just as strong, as the sensation of oneness with the loved one may echo the blissful experience of being merged with the mother in infancy. So romantic love is clearly a potent cocktail of cultural, biological, and psychological ingredients. However, somewhere along the road of Western civilization, the role of romance in an intimate relationship began to assume greater and greater importance, and the notion of a romantic relationship has gradually acquired an artificial quality, in that it is primarily fueled by fantasy, imagination, and the idealization of the other person. And all too often, when reality intrudes and one discovers the inevitable human flaws of one's lover, the romantic, idealized vision of the other person evaporates, and the relationship is in danger of collapse. From this perspective, perhaps the Dalai Lama's view of romance is not far off the mark, and this is why he encourages us to examine the underlying basis of a relationship, should we find ourselves in a relationship that is going sour. Sexual attraction, or even the intense feeling of falling in love, may play a role in forming an initial bond between two people, to draw them together. But like a good epoxy glue, that initial bonding agent needs to be mixed with other ingredients before it will harden into a lasting bond. Ingredients such as affection, compassion, and mutual respect as human beings.
Chapter 7. The Value of Compassion.
I truly believe that compassion provides the basis for human survival, the real value of human life, and that without that, there is a basic piece missing. And a compassionate attitude is something that we can always carry with us.
The development of compassion plays a far greater role in the Dalai Lama's life than simply as a means to cultivating a feeling of warmth and affection, a means of improving our relationships with others. It is an integral part of his spiritual path, a critical element in achieving the full realization of our spiritual potential. He further explained his views on the topic.
Compassion can be roughly defined in terms of a state of mind which is nonviolent, non-harming, and non-aggressive. It is a mental attitude based on the wish for others to be free of their suffering and is associated with a sense of commitment, responsibility, and respect towards the other. In the Tibetan word sewa, there is also a sense of state of mind that can wish for good things for oneself. In developing compassion, perhaps one could begin with the wish that oneself be free of suffering, and then taking that natural feeling and cultivating it, enhancing it, and then extending it out to include and embrace others. Now, when people speak of compassion, there is often a danger of confusing compassion with attachment. So when we discuss compassion, we must make a distinction between two types. One kind is tinged with attachment, the feeling of controlling someone or loving them so that they'll love you back. This ordinary type of compassion is quite partial and biased because it is based on perceiving the other person as a friend or someone who is close to you. But this kind of love or compassion is unstable. If there is a change, a disagreement perhaps, or your friend does something to make you angry, then all of a sudden, your mental projection changes. The concept, my friend, is no longer there. And your feeling changes, and you may even have a feeling of hatred. So that kind of love based on attachment can be closely linked with hatred. But there is a second type of compassion that is free from such attachment. That is genuine compassion. That kind is based on the rationale that every human being has an innate desire to be happy and overcome suffering just like myself. And just like myself, they have the natural right to fulfill this fundamental aspiration. On the basis of the recognition of this equality and commonality, you can feel compassion regardless of whether you view him or her as a friend or an enemy. It is based on the other's fundamental rights rather than your own mental projection. Making the distinction between these two kinds of compassion and cultivating genuine compassion can be quite important in our day-to-day life. For instance, in marriage, there is generally a component of emotional attachment. But if there is a component of genuine compassion as well, based on mutual respect, the marriage tends to last a long time. In the case of emotional attachment without compassion, the marriage is more unstable and tends to end more quickly.
It seemed to me that it might be quite difficult to develop that kind of universal compassion, that kind of generic compassion divorced from personal feeling. And since love and compassion is a subjective feeling, and a person would experience the same feeling or emotional tone in either type, why was it so important to distinguish between the two?
I think there is a different quality between the feeling of genuine love and compassion and love based on attachment. It's not the same feeling. The feeling of genuine compassion is much stronger, much wider. It has a very profound quality. For example, if you see an animal intensely suffering, like a fish writhing with a hook in its mouth, you might spontaneously experience a feeling of not being able to bear their pain. That feeling isn't based on a special connection with that particular animal, but simply on the fact that this being also has feeling, can experience pain, and has a right not to experience such pain. That kind of compassion is much more sound and more durable in the long run. I think that in one sense, one could define compassion as the feeling of unbearableness at the sight of other people's suffering. And in order to generate that feeling, one must first have an appreciation of the seriousness or intensity of another's suffering. So the more fully one understands suffering and the various kinds of suffering we are subject to, the deeper will be one's level of compassion.
I noted that by definition, compassion involves opening oneself to another's suffering, sharing another's suffering. But I asked the Dalai Lama, why would we want to take on another's suffering when we don't even want our own and go to great lengths to avoid it? His response was unhesitating.
I feel that there is a significant difference between your own suffering and the suffering you might experience in a compassionate state in which you take upon yourself and share other people's suffering. A qualitative difference. When you think about your own suffering, there is a feeling of being totally overwhelmed, a sense of being burdened, of being pressed under something, a feeling of helplessness. There's a dullness, almost as if your faculties have become numb. But in the case of compassion, the feeling is much different. You may still initially experience a certain degree of discomfort, but underlying the uncomfortable feeling is a very high level of alertness and determination because you are voluntarily and deliberately accepting another's suffering for a higher purpose. There is a feeling of connectedness and commitment, a feeling of freshness rather than dullness. So mental attitude makes a tremendous difference.
In recent years, there have been many studies that support the idea that developing compassion and altruism has a positive impact on many aspects of our physical health. Compassionate behavior also contributes to emotional health, as studies have shown that reaching out to help others can induce a feeling of happiness, a calmer mind, and reduce depression. While the scientific evidence backs up the Dalai Lama's position on the very real and practical values of compassion, we needn't rely solely on scientific studies and research. We can easily discover the links between caring, compassion, and personal happiness in our own lives and those around us.
Second Meditation on Compassion.
In discussing various techniques to cultivate compassion, the Dalai Lama has often mentioned the vital role of empathy, the ability to imagine oneself in another's situation. One of the most effective techniques of developing empathy is to begin by looking for the most fundamental trait we all have in common with others, our humanity. The following simple exercise, offered during one of the Dalai Lama's public talks, elegantly crystallizes his thoughts on the subject of cultivating compassion.
In generating compassion, you start by recognizing that you do not want suffering and that you have a right to happiness. This can be verified or validated by your own experience. You then recognize that other people, just like yourself, also do not want to suffer, and they have the right to happiness. So this becomes the basis of your beginning to generate compassion. So, let us meditate on compassion today. Begin by visualizing a person who is acutely suffering, someone who is in pain, or is in a very unfortunate situation. For the first 3 minutes of the meditation, reflect on that person's suffering in a more analytic way. Think about their intense suffering and the unfortunate state of that person's existence. After thinking about that person's suffering for a few minutes, next try to relate that to yourself, thinking, that individual has the same capacity for experiencing pain, joy, happiness, and suffering that I do. Then try to allow your natural response to arise, a natural feeling of compassion towards that person. Try to arrive at a conclusion, thinking how strongly you wish for that person to be free from that suffering, and resolve that you will help that person to be relieved from their suffering. Finally, place your mind single-pointedly on that kind of conclusion or resolution, and for the last few minutes of the meditation, try to simply generate in your mind a compassionate or loving state.
Part 3. Transforming Suffering. Chapter 8. Facing Suffering.
In the time of the Buddha, a woman named Kisukutami suffered the death of her only child. Unable to accept it, she ran from person to person, seeking a medicine to restore her child to life. The Buddha was said to have such a medicine. Kisukutami went to the Buddha, paid homage, and asked, "Can you make a medicine that will restore my child?" "I know of such a medicine," the Buddha replied, "but in order to make it, I must have certain ingredients." Relieved, the woman asked, "What ingredients do you require?" "Bring me a handful of mustard seed," said the Buddha. The woman promised to procure it for him, but as she was leaving, he added, "I require the mustard seed to be taken from a household where no child, spouse, parent, or servant has died." The woman agreed and began going from house to house in search of the mustard seed. At each house, the people agreed to give her the seed, but when she asked them if anyone had died in that household, she could find no home where death had not visited. In one house, a daughter, in another, a servant, in others, a husband or a parent had died. Kisukutami was not able to find a home free from the suffering of death. Seeing she was not alone in her grief, the mother let go of her child's lifeless body and returned to the Buddha, who said with great compassion, "You thought that you alone had lost a son. The law of death is that among all living creatures, there is no permanence." It is clear from many of the Dalai Lama's speeches and remarks that compassion and suffering are closely linked in his philosophy. It is difficult to learn genuine compassion without understanding suffering, and we cannot fully understand suffering without directly confronting it first. And yet we have so many ways of denying or avoiding our problems, pain, and suffering. In beginning to learn how to deal with suffering, the story of Kisukatami is very instructive. Her insight into the universal nature of human suffering did not lessen the inevitable suffering that came from her loss, but it did reduce the suffering that came from struggling against this sad fact of life. Although the Dalai Lama believes that we may move towards happiness and freedom from suffering, we must begin that process by accepting it as a natural fact of human existence and courageously facing our problems head on.
In our daily lives, problems are bound to arise. The biggest problems in our lives are the ones which we inevitably have to face, like old age, illness, and death. Trying to avoid our problems or simply not thinking about them may provide temporary relief, but I think that there is a better approach. If you directly confront your suffering, you will be in a better position to appreciate the depth and nature of the problem. If you are in battle, as long as you remain ignorant of the status and combat capability of your enemy, you will be totally unprepared and paralyzed by fear. However, if you know the fighting capability of your opponents, what sort of weapons they have, and so on, then you're in a much better position when you engage in the war. You might consider things like old age and death as negative, unwanted, and simply try to forget about them. But eventually, these things will come anyway. And if you've avoided thinking about these things, when the day comes that these events occur, it will come as a shock, causing unbearable mental uneasiness. However, if you spend some time thinking about old age, death, and these other unfortunate things, your mind will be much more stable when these things actually happen. You have already anticipated that they will occur. There's really no avoiding the fact that suffering is a part of life. And of course, we have a natural tendency to dislike our suffering and problems. I think that ordinary people don't view the very nature of our existence to be characterized by suffering. I mean, on your birthday, people usually say, "Happy birthday." But actually, the day of your birthday was the birth of your suffering. But nobody says, "Happy birth of suffering day." Our attitude towards suffering becomes very important because it can affect how we cope with suffering when it arises. Now, our usual attitude consists of any intense aversion and intolerance of our pain and suffering. However, if we can transform our attitude towards suffering, adopt an attitude that allows us greater tolerance of it, then this can do much to help counteract feelings of mental unhappiness, dissatisfaction, and discontent. I think how you perceive life as a whole plays a role in your attitude about suffering. For instance, if your basic outlook is that suffering is negative and must be avoided at all cost, and in some sense is a sign of failure, this will add a distinct psychological component of anxiety and intolerance when you encounter difficult circumstances, a feeling of being overwhelmed. On the other hand, if your basic outlook accepts that suffering is a natural part of one's existence, this will undoubtedly make you more tolerant towards the adversities of life. And without a certain degree of tolerance towards our suffering, our life becomes miserable, then it's like having a very bad night. That night seems eternal. It never seems to end. So, for me personally, the strongest and most effective practice to help tolerate suffering is to see and understand that suffering is the underlying nature of samsara, of unenlightened existence.
Samsara, a Sanskrit term, is considered a state of existence characterized by endless cycles of life, death, and rebirth. This term also refers to our ordinary state of day-to-day existence, which is characterized by suffering. All beings remain in this state, propelled by karmic imprints from past actions and negative delusory states of mind, until one removes all negative tendencies of mind and achieves a state of liberation. I mentioned to the Dalai Lama that the idea of the underlying nature of existence, at least our ordinary daily existence, which is characterized by suffering and is basically unsatisfactory, sounded somewhat discouraging and pessimistic.
When I speak of the unsatisfactory nature of existence, this is in the context of the overall Buddhist path. These reflections have to be understood in their proper context, which is within the framework of the Buddhist path. Unless this view of suffering is seen in its proper context, there is a danger of misunderstanding this type of approach as being rather pessimistic and negative. Consequently, it's important to understand the basic Buddhist stance towards the whole issue of suffering. We find that in Buddha's own public teachings, the first thing he taught was the principle of the Four Noble Truths, the first of which is the truth of suffering. A lot of emphasis is placed on the realization of the suffering nature of one's existence. The point that has to be borne in mind is that the reason why reflection on suffering is so important is because there is a possibility of a way out. There is an alternative. There is a possibility of freedom from suffering. By removing the causes of suffering, it is possible to attain a state of liberation, a state free from suffering. According to Buddhist thought, the root causes of suffering are ignorance, craving, and hatred. These are called the three poisons of the mind. These terms have specific connotations when used within a Buddhist context. For example, ignorance doesn't refer to a lack of information as it is used in an everyday sense, but rather refers to a fundamental misperception of the true nature of the self and all phenomena. By generating insight into the true nature of reality and eliminating afflictive states of mind, such as craving and hatred, one can achieve a completely purified state of mind, free from suffering. Within the Buddhist context, when we reflect on the fact that our ordinary day-to-day existence is characterized by suffering, this serves to encourage us to engage in the practices that will eliminate the root causes of our suffering.
I began to sense how reflecting on our suffering nature could play a role in accepting life's inevitable sorrows, and even as a valuable method of putting our daily problems in proper perspective. But I was curious to hear how the Dalai Lama dealt with suffering on a more personal level, how he handled the loss of a loved one, for instance. The subject arose in one of his public talks when an audience member, clearly in pain, asked him how to handle a great personal loss such as that of a child.
To some degree, that depends on one's personal belief. If someone believes in rebirth, then accordingly, I think there is some way to reduce sorry or worry. One can take consolation in the fact that the loved one will be reborn. For those people who do not believe in rebirth, then I think there are still some simple ways to help deal with the loss. First, you could reflect that if you worry too much, allowing yourself to be too overwhelmed by the sense of loss and sorrow, and if you carry on with that feeling of being overwhelmed, not only is it very destructive and harmful to yourself, ruining your health, but also it would not have any benefit to the person who has passed away. For example, in my own case, I have lost my most respected tutor, my mother, and also one of my brothers. When they passed away, of course, I felt very, very sad. Then I constantly kept thinking that it's no use to worry too much, and if I really love those people, then I must fulfill their wishes with a calm mind. So I try my best to do that. So I think if you've lost someone who is very dear to you, that's the proper way to approach it. You see, the best way to keep a memory of that person is to see if you can carry on the wishes of that person.